Yeah. So I was saying, how do you do that for clients? Like, so would you use like the dishwasher story for a client if you're writing for clients? Like, it seems like it's harder to, or maybe I'm just putting up a false barrier here, creating a problem where there's not one. How do you do that for clients? Cause you're not in their day-to-day life.
Great question. My answer to that is you find the right client that's willing to do that. And I did have a client, one of my last longest running clients, he was perfect for that because he was an open book. And mm-hmm. I told him, I said, hey, just call my voicemail and just anything during the day, just leave a 2 to 5 minute to 10 minute voicemail on my phone, as long as it'll take. And I'll turn that into a story. And he didn't care what I used. So okay. You know, if you have a client that's up for that, it's not hard to do. Because so one of them was, he was in Costco and he saw something, and it had to do, this guy was a fitness trainer, and he saw something about, you know, something, ingredients on a package or something, and he had an observation about it, and something else happened in the store. So if you're writing for clients, a lot of clients are not going to be on board for it. And I understand that and respect that.
But if they are, you basically have a process where you say, hey, when you see something, you start training them on, hey, when you notice this, send it to me. Okay. So that's kind of the.
And I try and make it as easy as possible. If they want to just type out an email or just leave it's very easy for people to call somebody's voicemail and just ramble on. And then I can make sense out of it. That's the way I found that's probably the easiest.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've had a client in the past. It was an industrial supplier, and had a pretty good relationship with them. And I did some similar things with them. And some of my best performing emails for them were very story-based. The other thing that I did is I used this, there's a service called Goldilocks.com that has like all the national holidays and the daily holidays and the weekly holidays, like the stupid stuff, like National Ice Cream Day, you know, whatever. And I would go through there. I have a whole kind of checklist that I use to spread. It's not a spreadsheet. It's more of a 2-column. You kind of come to the cross and you figure out like what's trending on Twitter and what's a counterpoint to that. And I kind of go to the, you know, where those two cross, and that's what I write about that day. Little matrix, I call it. But yeah, with clients, it's like it's just basically, hey, send me kind of stuff you see, and you start training them to give you what you need, and then you can flesh it out from there.
Yeah.
Like you just need the seed of the idea, right? You don't need the whole blown out email.
Right. But you can also feed them the seeds of the idea. I'll give an example with the fitness guy. I'm a sports fan, and I was watching Lamar Jackson of the Baltimore Ravens, and he was doing a press conference, and he was wearing a t-shirt that said, nobody care in huge letters, nobody cares, work harder. And that slogan fit exactly with my client. And so I texted him the photo. I go, give me your commentary on this. Just riff on this for 2 minutes, call my voicemail.
Yeah.
And so you can feed your client things that you see, and they might jog their memory of a story, or they just might want to go off on it, and you can turn that into an email.
Yeah. Yeah. That's brilliant. That's a great way to just help your client help you. And then sometimes they're going to give you something that spurs 2 or 3 or 4 other emails.
Oh yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So let's talk about kind of the structure of the email. Cause it's interesting what you said in this one that you sent today, that you don't have to tell a full story. In fact, you don't want to tell a full story. Kind of go into that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, when you read a good novel or you watch a great movie, the arc, the hero's journey arc, or whatever you want to call it, you close the last page of the novel, or you watch the closing credits scroll in a movie, and you get a feeling of resolution, you're satisfied, you're satiated. Well, when you think about it, if you're sending emails to your list, you don't want that. You don't want them to feel resolved. You want them to take an action. You want a CTA. Right. So it's kind of a misnomer when people think, oh, story-based emails. I want a character. I want conflict. I want a climax. I want to resolve it. And boy, what a great story. Well, you don't really want that in emails. You want to instead, like we talked about before, you want them to bond with you. You want them to see you as a likable character that you open their emails, but you also want to, just get them to, I lost my train of thought there.
It's basically, you said you, let's say we were talking about just not doing the full story, just part of the story. While you're thinking about it, because it'll come back if you don't try to.
Must be the beer.
So while you're thinking about, I'll say something I was thinking about that you could use for your thing. I was like, what would if I were going to title this method something, you know, if Bill asked me what I would title it, I was thinking today after I read this email from you, I was like, so it's not a 3-act play, right? It's more like a 1.5-act play. So it's almost like the 1.5-act email method.
What you're trying to do is just stimulate an emotional reaction in them. So let's say, I can't think of an example now, but if there's something they want in their life that your product solves, you want to stimulate that desire or hope they have and tell a story around that. And it may involve the solution, but you still want to tell it in a way that inspires them to take the next action.
I love that. I mean, Eugene Schwartz talks about that in his book, Breakthrough Advertising, right? It's like, you don't create the desire. You link your product to the existing desire.
Yeah. You can't force anybody to desire anything or force them into anything. You just want to rekindle what's already burning in there.
Absolutely.
And right. The story is the entryway into that.
Yeah. And then you just segue. Oh, by the way,
this solves it.
Yep. Yeah. And I think that's a good way to look at it. And again, that transition is something you have to practice and things like that. So, but I think that's a good thing. Cause I think sometimes the idea of a whole story could be a little intimidating, and it's really just like a story jumping off point. It's almost like a car chase scene in an action movie, or the opening, you know, kind of murder scene in if it's a mystery, like it's just enough to hook people and want to know how this ends.
Yeah. And that's a great point, because in many cases, my story-based emails aren't even telling a whole story. You're just using storytelling elements. It could be just a few lines of dialogue. You're not setting the scene. You're not building up characters. You're not creating a conflict. Even if you just use dialogue, like me muttering under my breath as I'm loading the dishwasher, that feels like a story right there. And that's enough. You don't need to tell a whole story, because even just using story elements, whether it's a telling detail or some dialogue, that's going to separate you from people that are just selling promotional emails where they're not doing any even storytelling elements at all. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing you can disabuse people of, is that you have to tell a whole story. Not only do you not want to, but to make it effective, you can just use different elements, and that's going to help.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, I mean, I've used some of this in B2B. And I think it works in B2B even better than it does in consumer, mm-hmm. because it's so rare there. I mean, it's pretty rare in, you know, B2C as well, but in B2B, like, I wrote one probably a month or two ago for a client who sells granite countertops, right? They sell and I told a story about, they have all these remnant samples from when they cut countertops, you know, and then they have like some leftover pieces and stuff like that, that are about the right size for bathrooms, but not big enough for kitchens. And we just kind of told a story, and like they were walking through the yard, they have all these leftover pieces, and they're like, what do we do with these? And and I've used that same basic story frame of like, oh, I was walking around, I'm the owner, I was walking around the warehouse, the yard, the whatever. And every time I've used that, it's done amazingly well.
Like, well, think about what a breath of fresh air it is compared to the white papers they're getting in, or a bullet list of all the features.
Yeah.
They're just stoked to read this actual story or something that feels like a story.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, it's with the cashier example, it's like they can relate to that. If they've had a business, they've got this extra stuff that's, you know, left over from doing this and that. Mm-hmm. A lot of people can resonate with that, you know? Yeah. So, and it just feels more authentic, right? It's like, hey, I've got a good friend of mine who talks about, I think he got it from Gary V. It's like, document your journey. Don't like sell it. Like, just document what's going on in your life. That's what like people get into. They like to, and I think you can do the same thing with your story-based emails. I mean, that's basically what you're doing with the dishwasher story, right? You're like, hey, this is what I was thinking.
Yeah. Why are reality shows so compelling for so many people? Because you're just along for the ride. Yeah. It could be the most mundane things they're doing. It could be them arguing in the kitchen, but you're riveted because you're a fly on the wall eavesdropping. And so, I mean, if you're writing emails and you're letting people be the fly on the wall in your house, people love that.
Yeah. I mean, who would have ever thought House Hunters on HGTV would be like the mega hit that it is? And like, you can't stop watching.
And it's like, not, there's not nothing about the houses.
Yeah. It's, there's nothing in it for you. The houses are half the time not something you would ever consider buying. Mm-hmm. But there's something about the relatability of going on that journey that people are like, they just can't look away. And then there's just the open loop of which one are they going to choose, right? Right.
Yeah. My wife watches that show, American Pickers. Are you familiar with that show?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not even into a lot of the things these guys collect, but I just love the interaction of that guy. He's so likable, and he's negotiating deals and just the most mundane things, the way people are standing next to each other, the body language, you're just, again, a fly on the wall, and it's, you can't stop watching it.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great example. Just, I mean, the stuff is everywhere. It's like, I mean, you could write an email, literally, if you were listening to this show, you could write an email about how absurd it is that people like House Hunters.
Exactly. Yep.
I mean, you know, so, and I think the thing is it does take practice. Like, it takes, when you were talking about the 10 examples in a day, I was like, when you first said that, I was like, that's a big promise to be able to 10 examples a day. Like, I don't know about that. But the more I think about it, the more I was like, yeah, but I think it's practice. It's waking up and noticing and not just going through your day, but actually making some notes. I was reminded of Taylor Swift. I heard a story about the way she writes her songs. If she just takes her iPhone and she has a notes tab in her iPhone that is just for song lyric ideas. It's not even the song lyrics. It's literally one line. She'll see it like a huge oak tree out the bus window. So she'll just write oak tree out bus window. And that's it. Puts it away. Never thinks about it again until it's songwriting day. But then it's the day to write songs. And she opens up that tab and she just starts putting pieces together or just expanding the idea or whatever. So I think if you know, one way you could put this into practice is when you have the conversation with the cashier, you just whip out your iPhone.
Sure.
You know, when you get back to the car, put it in the notes tab, you know, email story ideas, boom. And
yeah, I think that's a big part of it because so many people just go through their everyday lives and they're not recording the conversations or they're not.
Yeah. You got to capture it.
Exactly. They're not journaling at the end of the day or like you said, you know, opening up a spreadsheet or just, you know, jotting these things down and they just kind of flow through their life and they don't think about it anymore. But
yeah, we're all on autopilot.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, something happened earlier in this interview. There's a story right there. I completely got flummoxed and lost my train of thought. And Sean came in, recognized it, kind of saved it. That's an email that I might write someday.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that happened, you know, and there's probably 8 other things that happened. So it's just a matter of recognizing them in the moment. I love the example of Taylor Swift because all it takes is a few words to just capture that moment because you'll remember everything else around it just with those few words.
But if you don't capture it, that idea is gone forever.
That's right. Imagine if you had a file of those moments, say from 20 years ago. And I'm somebody who from, say, age 21 to about 42, I kept a journal almost every day. I have a stack in here. They're this high. And when I go back through them, guys, I read the most mundane thing that no way I would have remembered, but it brings in a whole constellation of related memories that I think when I'm 85 sitting in my rocking chair, I'm going to like reading because they would have been lost forever.
That's fantastic.
So get in the habit of doing this, of capturing those memories now. It's just a valuable thing to do.
What do you think about like, you know, as writers, like, writing prompt type books. Do you think that's valuable to help with this process or?
I do. In fact, in my course, I have about 150 questions to jog your memory. Like one that comes to mind is what was the view from your childhood bedroom window? And you think about that and you think about the view you saw, probably 10 related memories come rushing in. Yeah. And, you know, when was your first kiss is a common one. So there's a lot of kinds of questions you can jog your memory on. So I have a thing in my course. It's a memory prompter to help people come up with these stories because people too easily dismiss that they've lived a full life and that there's all kinds of memories there, but it's just, you just think of it as your life, but there's a lot of stuff there. and it's all usable.
So I heard this quote today from Rich Sheffrin, who's been on the show, and just love his work. And he said today, it's just like hit me like a ton of bricks, especially cause, probably because I was thinking about this podcast. But he said the most personal things in your life that you don't really want to talk about are also the most common widespread issues in humanity.
Yeah. So, I don't know if I heard that from Rich, but I've heard that. And it's, what is that phrase? It's the most, there's a famous quote. If you go to Goodreads and look it up, it's basically the most common things in life are the most profound.
Yeah. Same. Yeah. Same idea. It's like, so the fact that, like, I mean, comics are a great example, right? This, I took a stand-up comedy class about 3 years ago, did a set in a bar and hold the bit, loved it. I need to do that again when bars really open again. But they have formulas. Like when I went to the class, I was like, oh man, this is all art. Like you just have to have a knack for it and things like that. But then they started breaking down the formula, and it's basically, it's a mind map, right? So you put a topic in the middle. And maybe we should interview a stand-up comic, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Put that out on Harrow. Yeah. But so you basically start with a topic in the middle, like kids or teenagers. Let's go with teenagers. It's a little more specific than kids, right? So teenagers. And then they, off that, they'll put like weird. There's like four key words that they started with. I don't remember. I have to look at my notes. But like four different directions that you could go with that, you know. Weird, frustrating, something else and something else. And then you just kind of build off of those, like, yeah. And it starts to prompt your memories. Cause it's even back in my sales days when I was in home, one of the greatest referral techniques that I ever learned was people often ask for referrals and they'll say, hey, who else do you know that could use something like this? You know, just basic. Right. And people's brains can't process that much information because they know 50 to 100 to 200 people, right? Sure. But if you say who in your Sunday school class mm-hmm. could benefit from something like that, immediately it narrows down the possibilities, right?
Yeah.
Who at the last family reunion that you were at could use, you know, what we do. That was one technique. So you narrow down for them. And I think that's kind of what your prompts do, right? They narrow down a time in your life that then triggers more clarity. Because otherwise your brain's trying to sort an entire lifetime or an entire whatever.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And isn't Jerry Seinfeld's entire career based on ordinary moments?
I think most comedians are.
Yeah.
I mean, that whole show was based off of ordinary stuff. Yeah, nothing, basically. It's a show about nothing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, and even most great sitcoms. I mean, Friends. I mean, they're sitting in the coffee shop talking about dating. Like, there's nothing, nothing new about that, right? Mm-hmm. It's just they're just going through life. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's the ordinary stuff is what makes it relatable. So I think people need to. It's easy to dismiss that stuff, especially in an Instagram world. Where it's like you have to hike the Himalayas with a chimpanzee on your back while wearing, you know, $300 designer, you know, hiking shorts and, you know, whole L.L. Bean get up or whatever. Yeah. But the fact is, like, getting pissed off about the way your wife does the dishwasher is much more relatable.
Sure.
Than the first, you know, than hiking the Himalayas. Most people have never done that. And they never will. And they don't expect that they ever will.
Yeah.
They might want to, but they can't actually feel it in their gut when you talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they can definitely feel the annoying of their wife in their gut.
Yeah.
Oh, my wife's not listening right now. I said that with a lot of passion.
A little too much.
Yeah. It's just more real to people.
You know, that's interesting too, though. B2B, you know, it's real uncomfortable for people in B2B business to get that personal. And so, you know, you know, it's a little different when you're writing to B2C, you know, your consumer audience, but when you're writing to corporate, you know, emails, and I find this, you know, because I'm in that field, you know, exposing like the everyday, the mundane everydays of life and turning those into stories, it almost makes you feel in some parts vulnerable to some degree, But so there's a challenge, and I think getting over that, you know, when it comes to, you know, B2B marketing.
Yeah, I think in those cases, not to be pessimistic, but the only way to maybe sway a person into this type of marketing is to do a, make them do a split test and show them that revenue goes up if you get a little more personal. Mm-hmm. It's uncomfortable because I know the crowd you're talking about. It's really hard to get. It was hard for me to open up, and I'm kind of an open book. I didn't want to expose my inner thoughts to thousands of people, but people love that. And so it's, it can be tough, but you know.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, Jonathan, because what a especially bigger B2B people do, what type of stuff do they do to get sales and things? They go on golfing trips together. They go on hunting trips together. That's they invite you to their box at a sporting event. Like, and that's all to try to relate and get away from business and be more common.
Exactly.
But then they're scared to write an email like that where they, you know, talk about that kind of stuff.
That's
but they'll spend thousands of dollars to take you on a, you know, big game hunting adventure or whatever.
Sure.
Well, there's something about it. I think what it is, Sean, is there's something about committing it to paper or an email that just, it's that extra step that just feels like they can't go there.
Right.
I agree. I mean, you know, I have a coaching business too, and you know, that's the hardest part of it is just putting those things on and letting the world see it. Like, you know, like, you know, for instance, right now, I'll be 50 this month, you know, coming up and in March. And, you know, there's a whole series of stories around that. My son is grown and he doesn't talk to us right now because he's on the other side politically than what we are. And it's created this divide in the house. And as a quote life coach, how can I talk about that? My life's not together. My son doesn't talk to me. Like it's, you know, it creates all this imposter syndrome and everything. But if I would talk about it more, you'd be like, oh my God, I totally get that.
Right.
But for some reason there is that fear that people are going to judge you, think you don't have your act together. Then you're going to be kicked out of the tribe and you know, the whole, you know, all the weird fears that come up in our brains.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're right that if you got it out there, you'd probably be astonished by the reaction you got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my friends who, he's kind of into coaching, but he would just start making these posts. And one day he made this post, and this has been 5 or 6 years ago. He made this post about hanging out with his ex-wife and her husband and their new kid. And he was holding the baby, and that was the picture. And he kind of told this story of how it was a terrible divorce, but now they're friends. And that literally launched his career online because that post went viral and completely changed his life. And, you know, so just, I mean, people are desperate for that. They're desperate because they feel alone. Mm-hmm. If you don't share those little things, they're not going to know.
But you brought up a great point about storytelling. The one reason that resonated, I would say, is because it showed a complex character. Mm-hmm. It showed two sides, like Tony Soprano. I mean, here's a hitman who did awful things that you rooted for.
Yeah.
I mean, how beautiful is that, that, you know, a screenwriter can do that. So when somebody shows different sides, we resonate it because we know that's true.
Yeah. I think the, another show recently, we've talked about this before, Jonathan, Cobra Kai. I don't know if you've watched that, Bill. Yeah. Man, that is the most back and forth show where you're rooting for two different people.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the retelling. It's the up to date or the current lives of the Karate Kid characters in the original Karate Kid. Oh. If you haven't seen it. So it's, you know, Daniel and John and what was his name? Johnny. Yep. So it's those two characters. Daniel's a big success cause he won the tournament. Johnny is like out and living in, you know, drinking and living in an apartment because he lost that tournament back, you know, in the Karate Kid scene. But the way they write the story, like one episode you're pulling for Daniel, the next episode you hate him and you're pulling for Johnny. Yeah. Like it's just the complexity of both of them is just absolutely.
Oh yeah.
Probably the best, the most well done, you know, you usually have a key enemy or a key bad person in a series. This just flip flops back and forth.
Yeah, it pulls you like you're like a tiger.
You don't know who to
back
for.
And forth every episode.
Yeah. And you see yourself in. Yeah, you see yourself in both of them.
Yeah, it's compelling because that's real life.
Yeah.
You know, Superman back in the day was, you know, all great traits, and then you get to something like Breaking Bad, and you see a character that's just more flippy, because that's all of us.
Well, that's another show right there in and of itself, which is probably my all-time favorite show. Yeah.
And that's what made Marvel
everyday life. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's why Marvel outdoes DC Comics most of the time, because their characters are more complex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you see more angles. I mean, you know, Thanos, he wants to destroy the world, but you kind of get it. Like, you're like,
right,
I see your point, buddy. I like, yeah, things are out of control. Maybe we should get rid of half the people. I don't know. You know, so it's like you kind of get them, and they've got a little humor.
But those are superheroes, right? I mean, those are I mean, like Walter White, that guy, you know, everybody can relate to a guy that's struggling. He's, you know, middle-aged guy.
Sees an opportunity
where he's like, he's going nowhere in life, had all of these dreams and aspirations, you know, and has found himself as like teaching science at a high school. It's like,
and if you think that can't happen to you, then go watch and then tell me.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, one thing, and then we'll wrap up, and Bill, people can find out more about you. But so that last chain of thought there, especially the Marvel part, they do humor really well. How do you work? Do you use humor in a lot of your stuff, or do you kind of shy away from that? Because some people say it's really hard to pull off humor and copy. Other people say it's.
That's one of those things I hate to say is maybe more art than science, because a lot of people, you can't force funny. And I wrote an email about this probably before you got on the list, but there's a difference between being funny and witty. Like, I'm not a person who tells jokes. I'm pretty witty, but I don't like to tell jokes. So if it's not in your nature to be funny, I wouldn't try and force it, but you can find humor in everything.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I don't think I have a good answer for you, but I do know that people are entertained by funny and humor.
Yeah.
So if you can do it, don't hold back.
Right.
And even if it's maybe corny, I wouldn't hold back if it's really you, because people will see through that.
Right.
Yeah.
So
that's a good example. Just kind of letting your voice come out. Like, yeah. So like, I mean, one of the companies I work with, I'm kind of the witty guy on Slack. So I just put these dry comments in. Like throughout the day on Slack, and it's like, it's entertainment for everybody. And I know it's entertainment for everybody, and it's just enough to kind of break the monotony of the day and little things like that. That's just kind of a thing that I've picked up, like this kind of dry wit, you know, that I have, and I can pull it off in writing. Not everybody can pull it off in writing. So you kind of need to know, can you pull it off in writing or not? I think, and it does, again, it takes practice. Like it is, you know, I can sit there for 3 or 4 minutes sometimes trying to rearrange just the right words to get the right effect. And you gotta be fast on Slack, because otherwise it'll get buried and you'll lose the moment. Mm-hmm. So you also have to know the moment.
Yeah. One thing I like to do is, if I can, I don't always get to do this, but if I write an email and then I sleep on it and look at it the next day, sometimes I can tell I either went too far, or this is just, I was just trying to delight myself too much and it's not going to work for other people. Sure. But like I said, you got to be true to who you are. The guy that comes to mind is the father character in Modern Family.
Uh-huh. Yes.
He's such a cornball. He's such a cornball, but it really works for him. It's endearing. Sure. So if he wrote emails in that sense, you would get it from him, but you wouldn't want to force it on somebody that's not them.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So Phil, right? Phil Dunphy.
Phil, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 It's like the ultimate dad joke guy, right? I mean, that's his character, is the dad joke guy.
Yeah.
And then you got his father-in-law, who's too serious, B2B guy, like
closets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's a great example. Like, you got to own your thing. Each of those characters has something that makes them special. And that's why you watch the show.
Right.
Same with The Office or any of these other, you know, shows. Like, every character has kind of their thing, and you have to know your voice and just go through your life with that voice and not be ashamed of it, I think, is kind of what I'm picking up from this.
Yeah.
Whew, man, that hour and 15 minutes flew by. So,
you know, the final thing I'll say about that is, when you own it like that, when you own your own style, it's hard to do, but you'll be amazed to find that a slice will resonate with that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Some won't, but as you know, Ben Sennel writes about this a lot. And Andre Chaperon writes about this too. You want to repel people as much as attract them.
Yeah, absolutely.
If your own particular brand of weirdness repels some people, that's fine. You're not trying to please everybody.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great reminder. And that's scary for, I know it's scary for myself. Scary for a lot of people, but when you do it, you see it, but you got to do it enough times to get over that, the fear part of it. I don't know if you ever totally get over the fear of it. I guess I haven't done enough to get completely over the fear. But yeah. So Bill, to wrap up here, how can people learn more about what you do? If they found this kind of interesting and want to give it a try, how can they learn more about your methods and what you're up to?
The current project I have, it's storysalesmachine.com, just the way it sounds.
Okay.
And if people want to drop me an email, it's bill@storysalesmachine.com.
Okay. All right. There you go.
Very cool. Yeah. So I've been checking out the course. So tell us real briefly, give us kind of a little brief summary of that course that you walk people through.
Yeah, well, we talked earlier about that email is, you know, probably the best ROI, probably the money that's being most left on the table. I decided to create a system that helps people re-engage their list, email their list with stories that are not hype-based, that are more story-based. Mm-hmm. So I created a system that allows them to find their own stories, gives them a way to email their list in a compelling way that keeps them engaged. And that's basically it. It's kind of turns it into a system where you mine your own stories, come up with a system to get the email out there and go from there.
And you have templates. So just say you have templates, because that'll sell twice as much.
People do love the templates, and I spend a lot of time on those. I also have a collection of 50 done-for-you stories. If you don't want to, we've talked a lot here about creating your own stories. I created a collection of 50 done-for-you stories that you can drop in your emails, just copy and paste them and make a segue and a transition. Sure. And that document also has about 88 transitional phrases you can use to do that.
Yeah.
So that's another way that I've tried to make it easier for people to use stories in emails.
That's awesome.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's cool, man. 50 drop-in stories. So it's 50 or 80, 50. That's cool.
Yeah. And sometimes I'm sure some of those stories kind of like they'll spur like your own stories, you know, that are like kind of, you know, sometimes when we're kind of told I share a story and we can't think of anything, but then, you know, you go to some of the stuff that you read out and you're like, oh yeah, I know exactly. I've had something similar like that happen in my own life. So that kind of helps me tell my own story.
And I would challenge listeners to go back and listen to this whole podcast episode a second time with like a notepad or, you know, notes tab in your phone. Cause we gave a lot of hints and clues, and I'm sure that jogged stuff for people, but they probably didn't capture them. So that's the other thing. You got to capture this stuff. Like, I promise you, it's so hard. I mean, you know, you've got a system, Bill, that your brain is kind of trained to kind of collect things through the day and then dump them at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But until you get there, capture them as you go. Yeah. And then also maybe do a recap at the end of the day. Everybody talks about morning routines, but I'm bigger on like end of day routines personally.
Sure.
That's a whole nother episode right there, Jonathan. Yeah. See, there's two episodes right there. Stand-up comedy.
I was just going to say the stand-up comedy. I want to hear that story because I'm just so fascinated by guys that can get up there and do that.
It's a lot more science than you would imagine. Like you still have to notice, but once you learn the formulas, it's easier to notice. And I think the same is true for your stuff, Bill. Like once you understand the frameworks, it's easier to notice things out in the wild and know what you need to capture and what not to. So
did you have a script or it all written down and memorized it? Or did you just kind of have bullet points and riff, or how'd that go?
Yeah, I just, I'll send you the video, but, I had the bullet, I had it index cards because the audience actually knew we were a class and we were doing this. So I had I just made that part of my act. You know, I was like, I had a bunch of, I actually took a whole deck full of cards up there. So it would be nice and thick. And I was like, yeah, I've got a few notes, you know, and then I would turn it over. So I just used a couple of like to hit the main points and make sure I got things in the right order. Cause even the order of the jokes is scripted out. You do your second best joke first, your best joke last, your third kind of in the middle, and then you weave other stuff together.
Sure.
So if you've got a, you know, 6 or 7 minute set, you know, you lead with the second best, end with the first, third best is in the middle, and then your fourth, fifth, and sixth joke or so is kind of ties those three together. You try to find an arc that ties those three together, and that's your set, you know, for a typical 6 to 10 minute set.
Yeah, I am fascinated by the whole science of funny because it is a science.
It is. It's fascinating. So we'll definitely have to get that on there because that's some of the best comics in the world, especially the higher echelon comics, are some of the most persuasive people in the world. If you look at, you know, a lot of the night show people and things like that, I mean, they're persuading entire generations that this is the worldview, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there's a lot of people who get their news from Colbert and these other night shows more than they do, you know, whoever's on the nightly news. Yep. So it can be very persuasive. Comedy can be very persuasive as well.
Yeah, and just like with marketing, where the ultimate arbiter is whether people pull out their credit card sales, whether it worked or not. You might think it's a great piece of writing, but did people buy? Jerry Seinfeld likes to say, there's only one true form of justice in this world. Did they laugh?
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. It's kind of like in the gym. Like, you know, the weight doesn't care how tired you are, how motivated you are. Mm-hmm. Did you lift it or not? Like, right. There's no opinion. You either lifted it or you didn't.
Scoreboard.
Yep. So,
Bill, right, thanks so much. Yeah, appreciate you coming on and spending some time with us. Again, we'll mention your website, storysalesmachine.com. That's the best way people can find out more about your course, learn about that. I tell you, you give away some incredible value, and your copy's spot on. But we'll be posting the link for our listeners. And thanks for the time today. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed it.
All right. We're going to send you to the green room for a second. Sean and I are going to wrap up, and we'll bring you up for a second after if you've got a few minutes to hang tight. Good stuff, man. Enjoyed that.
Yeah. And there's a lot of good stuff in that episode. You got to listen to that one twice at least.
Yeah. If you'll notice, I was like, my head was down. I was taking like quite a few notes.
Yeah. So I would recommend too that first you buy Bill's course, second, and we're not doing an affiliate program or anything. It's just a course I'd recommend.
Yep.
At the very least, get on his email list. You can learn a lot just kind of going through that and seeing how it's done. Definitely and actually so. Experiencing it for yourself and how you feel when he tells the stories.
Right.
Definitely go for that.
Good stuff.
John, I'll let you wrap up.
All right, guys. As always, you can find us persuasionabythepint.com. You can find us on all of your podcast platforms. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.